Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode, as we near the end of the year, we're going to take a quick break from our RNDF coverage and feature a conversation with The Intercept and Counterpoint's Ryan Grimm. He's got a great new book out. It's called The Squad, AOC, and the Hope of a Political Revolution. Now, despite not sharing AOC or The Squad's politics, I've always been really fascinated by them as a category because from a political perspective, they fill a similar space to the Realignment podcast. Obviously, as elected officials, they're obviously operating at a higher level when it comes to stakes, but I think ultimately my project and their legislative and political work are emerging from this post-2008, post-2016 intellectual and political milieu where we're analyzing, hey, how does capitalism work? How does our political system work? And is the response to the various failures that the Trump presidency and election combined with the 2008 financial crisis, are these failures best dealt with by reform or do we actually require revolution to address them? So this question of whether or not the AOC squad approach is going to be an effective one in the Democratic Party is going to emerge way beyond just in 2020 and 2024 and actually matter a lot in 2028. So I hope you guys definitely check out this book, lots of great reporting, but I think this conversation gets at the ideas behind this moment. Hope you all enjoy the conversation and have a great weekend. Ryan Grimm, welcome to The Realignment.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's really great to chat with you. This is a book and just a frame overall that I'm really obsessed with. So let me just start with a really obvious question. Is America a country where political revolution is a framework for understanding how social change happens?
I think it can be, because I think if you look at the way that social change has happened in the past, it has involved political revolution, whether you obviously go back to the founding of the country, you know, an actual revolution, but then the Civil War involved, you know, a real, I think of it as a second revolution. It, like all revolutions, it waxed and waned. It had its revolutionary period during Reconstruction, and then it got, you know, Jim Crow absorbed it back in. But what came out after that second revolution has been called a second founding. Like, it was different than what happened in the revolution before. I think the New Deal, reasonably considered to be, you know, you could call that a political revolution. I think LBJ, the civil rights movement, and the Great Society could qualify as that. I think Reagan, the Reagan Revolution, you know, they call it the Reagan Revolution. I think is a reasonable framework to understand it. And even if the revolution didn't do everything it wanted to, it, you know, post-Reagan America for 40 years was different than pre-Reagan America. So I think it's fair. I think it is a decent way to understand it. And, you know, it's a Bernie Sanders phrase, political revolution. He means we're not going to have guillotines. You know, we're not putting people up against a wall. But we're, you know, revolutionizing the way that we think about our participation.
Yeah, and I think you gave the correct answer. But I think part of the problem here is I would be curious what you think either a member of the squad or the type of person who you're writing very eloquently about in the 2010s, who kind of forms the activist base of, let's just say, like the left part of like the Democratic Party. Because to a certain point, if we're going to talk about FDR's revolution, you see this collapse with the Great Depression, and then you have the fact that, you know, FDR was a governor and you had all this like intellectual scaffolding that had been put together over a couple mm-hmm. years. I think that looks a little different than I think a lot of the opportunity that Bernie and a lot of leftists saw in the 2010s. So I guess the real question would be, how would you say the squad, Bernie, et cetera, how would they define political revolution in a way that's different than changing the Constitution or incremental policy change, stuff like that?
I think if they had seized the White House in 2020 with Bernie in the White House and a resurgent insurgent squad kind of with a megaphone in Congress, and let's say they win both the Senate and the House, that's a political revolution. Like what they do with it, remains to be seen. You know, Bernie could have been in jail by like 6 months in after Afghanistan. Like how the system responds to somebody like Bernie Sanders in the White House is one thing, or how he responds. Like he may have
become, what you meant by the Bernie in jail thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a joke, but like if Bernie had gone through with the Afghanistan withdrawal the same way that Biden did, and there was some chaos amid the withdrawal, not that they would put him in jail, but he would have obviously already have lost Republicans, never had Republicans, and he would lose most of the Democratic Party probably by that point. So you certainly don't have Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema voting for anything that he's putting through is my guess. So the political revolution would require probably somebody else from the squad coming into power down the road with a bigger base behind them.
Yeah, that's a really interesting counterfactual in the sense that, and you know this because you cover the news, I think a lot of like the center left and center right space that tends to be Joe Biden's base was in an awkward place when it came to the Afghan withdrawal. And I think a lot of that awkwardness wouldn't have existed if this could have all been blamed right, from yes. idea to implementation on leftists kind of coming into power. So, okay, so here's the next question. And this is why I really wanted to pick up on that Bernie and Afghanistan point you made. I think the point you're making speaks to the fragility of a political coalition that the squad, et cetera, can really put together in a way that if you're looking at the right, where most of my expertise exists, when the right is in power, despite pressure points, despite difficulties, let's say, for example, Trump increasingly coming into conflict with evangelicals over abortion leading in 2024, there's still clearly a strong coalition that is going to advance the broad program and the broad project that doesn't exist in the Democratic Party. Why is that? And how does that kind of relate to the story you're telling in the book?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I would leave some of the right-wing analysis to you, but I could tell you on the left, the coalition that's developed after kind of the, you had the New Deal coalition, and then you had that kind of break apart and form into what is, what is now the Democratic coalition has always been a coalition. You know, it's been groups of different people. You got corporate, liberal Democrats. You've got environmentalists. You've got feminists. You've got a civil rights community. You have LGBT. What was LG, then LGBT. What's left of union, the union movement in the United States, all. And so it's not obvious
you are missing the defining Biden era group, suburban middle class to upper middle class women, right. A true defining pivot point base for the party.
Right. Which then is, it's since the 80s, you've kind of had a kind of reorganization, not just in the U.S., but around the world, as you know, with upper middle class and college educated voters gravitating toward center left parties. You have seen that pretty much everywhere. And so, yes. So then, it's not obvious what every little piece of that coalition has in common with itself, other than opposition to the opposing coalition, which is a little bit more homogenous. It's slightly less homogenous now that it's a coalition of working and middle class people and rich people, though it's still racially it's 90% at this point white. So homogeneity I think probably binds it together in a way that whereas the Democratic Party is still a coalition of a bunch of different kind of interest groups in a way that they haven't formed into a single movement, really.
Man, and I think in that explanation, you just A, demonstrated why the Democratic Party is going to have a like structural enthusiasm weakness, right? Like, because something people, especially on the left on Twitter, like to talk about is, oh man, like you're asking me to vote for like the lesser of two evils. Like, that's the definition of an argument you're going to make if you are a coalition of people mm-hmm. who are opposed to something happening. So maybe on the face of it, that's a weakness for the broader Democratic Party. But I think when it comes to the Democratic Party being resistant to the efforts of the squad, to the efforts of third parties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that's actually a real strength, because any upsetting the apple cart, any we're going to sit this election out, any kind of playing chicken, clearly, whether or not it happens in like the final analysis, at an articulation level, it's very easy to say, guys, the modern Democratic Party exists to make sure that Republicans don't get another two Supreme Court justices. Anyone who's not on board for basically keeping that mission together needs to put up or shut up. And that seems to me to be an actually pretty convincing argument when you look at abortion politics, when you look at climate politics, the need to pass legislation, and the fact that a hostile court could really shut everything down. How do you kind of think about that dynamic playing out?
I think that's right. I think for some, the way that Biden has given this borderline unconditional support to Israel amid the slaughter in Gaza has crossed a line where it went from strategic and pragmatic into kind of moral territory. Where they're just like, that's a bridge too far. Like I understand all that politics and coalition building requires compromises. That's for y'all. I'm getting off the train. I can't go any further. We'll see how many people, make that decision. But I think you're right in general that it doesn't require then the Democratic Party to necessarily stand for anything other than we're not them and we need to stand together to kind of beat them.
You can kind of attack that, but at the same time, and especially given the power of the executive branch, the weakness of Congress, it really does lead you into a like high stakes political moment where things really just do swing those different directions. So I guess here's the real question I'd ask for you to take us back to kind of the beginning. Once again, I love the setup at the start of the book. You're really framing the rise of the squad in the post 2008 moment. So you have a combination of just like the horrific impacts, the horrific generational impacts of the Great Recession, but also dissatisfaction, I think fair and unfair, there's different buckets there with the Obama era response to that. I guess the real question is, going back to Occupy, why did the events of 2008, 2009, 2010 not lead to some greater political accomplishment beyond just getting Biden to be more left than he probably would have been if Trump had never entered and American politics had just continued on the sort of H.W. Bush to Clinton to W. Bush to Obama back to Hillary? What kind of explains why the revolution didn't really come?
Well, I think that the people that Obama surrounded himself with were very direct holdovers front and standard bearers, really, not just holdovers of the kind of Reuben Clinton wing of the Democratic Party that was ascended in the 1990s. And they were not moved, by the 2008 financial crisis. Like they still had the same ideology in place. And that's going to happen throughout history, that even though like history has hit a breaking point and things have changed after it, you still got the same people from back here that are still alive in this time. And because of the way power works, many of them still have their hands on the levers of power. Obama, by virtue of going from the state Senate to the Senate in 2004 and then immediately leaping into the presidential campaign trail, he gave that convention speech in 2004 no blue states, no red states, just the United States, becomes a phenom. And from then on, pretty much, he's not even sworn into the Senate yet. From then on, he's got his eye on the White House. And so he came into the White House one of the least prepared kind of executives in the last 100 years or something, because, he had just, he'd been a constitutional scholar. He's obviously a very bright guy. But he hadn't been a governor. He hadn't he had been a senator, but not really performed the duties. He passed an ethics bill, which was just a way of like burnishing his like I'm above Washington kind of credentials. But he didn't engage in like the legislative back and forth in any serious way. And so when he came to the White House, he was more deferential to advisors than most presidents would be, because most presidents, you know, had more experience. And so, and he had these advisors like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and others who had very kind of anti-revolutionary ideas about what they ought to do in the wake of the financial crisis. Like you had people saying like break up Citibank, very serious people. Like it was kicked around even by advisors in the White House, but his team was just like, no, like absolutely not. We're not like, we can't, we're not going to spend that. We can't spend more than 700, 800 million, billion on this stimulus. We can't break the banks up. We got it. You know, so they were very cautious about their approach to it. And I think that creates this schism then that Occupy kind of drives.
You know, what's so interesting about the story, and you're referring to, you know, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin from the 90s, you know, I think it's straightforward to politically, I think, policy attack the Clintonian like third way approach from the 90s, but it was a politically successful operationalizing aspect. So at least in the 90s, you can say, look, we've accomplished this like long-standing political feature. We win the popular vote going into 2001. But what is missing when it comes to the Obama era is not only are the policies out of step with the moment, but actually as a political project, it doesn't seem to be as sustainable. You know, something I'm curious about then, and this is where this gets really fascinating when you're talking about both like the squad, but also just this kind of alternate media space that you and I are in. Like race gets very, very, very uncomfortable, and people are uncomfortable with it on a couple different levels. So here's the real question for you that I want to know. Let's say, when we put on my most like, I'm trying to find the right hat for this, my most like establishment, ultimately comfortable with how things are, corporate Democrat lens, who thinks of things mostly through a racial lens. You know, Ryan, let's say, merits of the policy aside, let's say Obama broke up Citibank. At the end of the day, the Tea Party and the backlash to him were racial in their nature. And the idea that the Obama presidency could have been a presidency that was both like either revolutionary or in on one end or unifying in the lens that he would kind of frame things in a 2004 sense was ultimately doomed, because we have to see American politics, especially in the 2010s, through the lens of racial backlash to a Black person being in the White House. I'm curious like what you think your reaction would be when it comes to that.
I mean, certainly you're going to get some racial backlash. Like that's a phenomenon that we're familiar with in the US and everywhere around the world. But it feeds off of and it interacts with people's kind of material anxieties. And so the less of that you have, then the less potency you're going to have for some of the kind of racial backlash would be my take on it. That you would have, like, you were all in the wake of the global financial crisis and the inadequate response to it, you were always going to get two strains of populism coming out of it. You know, you were going to get a right wing strain of it, and you were going to get a left wing strain of it. And what Obama ended up symbolizing was an attempt to kind of keep the lid on that and to do a kind of Davos style, the rich are really going to figure this out. And this was coming at the same time that big tech was really exploding, and big tech back then had this halo around it that these were like good people who were dropping acid and thinking about how to make the world a better place. They just happened to have made billions of dollars, but really they're connecting people and they're creating revolutions all over the world. Like, look what they're doing in Egypt and elsewhere. And that kind of utopianism then kind of becomes a mask for Obama's kind of version of like establishment. We're just going to keep the lid on populism. Mm-hmm. And so if Obama instead veers off with the kind of left-wing strain of populism, then some of that resentment and anger that was ultimately channeled into racial backlash might not have, because you had plenty of people who voted for him, so who then took part in the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. Not a ton, but you know, some. You had, you know, there were Obama, there's, you know, non-trivial number of Obama to Trump voters, and so that's they're still somewhat at the margins, but those are the margins at which power is won or lost.
And looking at 2016 and 2020, those Obama to Trump voters are the voters that actually made the difference. Right. So politics is actually decided ultimately at the margins. And I think what you just said is I think the most effective response, which is that putting aside longer term racial discourse in this country, the fact that these voters were willing to vote for Obama once basically means that, like, okay, how useful is the conception that they voted for him like the first time? Right. It'd be a whole other thing if, you know, President Obama is elected in 2008 and then all of a sudden all these like non-voting white people come out of the rafters to like vote him down in 2012. I think that'd be a scenario where that's a pretty blackpilling scenario from a racial discourse perspective. But I think what I'm actually really appreciating from you is that you have kind of the right-wing populism, which is the Tea Party. You have like the left-wing attempt at populism, and ultimately, I think Obama's personal charisma and structural weaknesses of the Republican Party in 2012 with Mitt Romney as the nominee were just such that the weakness of like the center left generic Davos, we're going to do the big Simpson-Bowles commission and focus on the debt and deficit, that politics got way more success than it would have given just Obama's strength, right? Like there's a reason why Obama probably would have run re-election in 2016. Like he just is in of himself. He's like a confounding variable in any of this analysis.
Yeah. And he also ran an extremely populist campaign, like the Simpson-Bowles and all the debt ceiling austerity crap, notwithstanding 2010 and 2011. By 2012, his rhetoric was pure populism. Like, and Mitt Romney gave them no other choice. You know, like they
47%.
Ran 47%, an actual plutocrat whose actual company had actually like harvested the pensions of companies in Michigan and bankrupted them. And like it was,
I love you, by the way, saying the actual, because you're like, I'm not being a political hack here. Right. This is quite
He literally did it. Yeah. As Joe Biden would say, literally, and I mean literally. And so it was just sitting there for them. But the Clintons probably don't take those shots, you know. But the Obama campaign was like, no, this is like we're going here. And also, Mitt Romney had that, you know, let Detroit go bankrupt situation. And I think people who are a little younger than I am might not remember how close the big three were to just going under. And there were Democrats, Rahm Emanuel, one of them, saying, just let him go. Screw him. This is let the free market do its work. But Obama came in and made what at the time was a risky decision and bailed out Detroit. Mitt Romney at the time was saying, do not bail out Detroit. And the unfortunate headline of his Wall Street Journal column was, let Detroit go bankrupt, which he complained about.
Famously, he did not actually choose. I just read the McKay Coppins. Yeah. He did not. Look, that's one of those. Look, man, if you're going to run for president again, really, really be aggressive. Either don't write it or be aggressive on policing. And I think that the funny thing, I think actually that's a really interesting point to talk about the Detroit automakers, because, man, talk about alternate realities. Imagine a 2012 or 2016 where under the Obama administration, we're not just talking about Solyndra collapsing, right? Like the, you know, Green Initiative, but we're saying like under the Democrats' leadership, GM, Ford, like these companies collapsed. That would have been, talk about problems in the industrial Midwest with like white working class voters. So that was a good political call to take that risk.
Yeah. And I think that a key reason that that Hillary lost in 2016 and Trump won was a lot of those voters thought, you know, there was no longer the gratitude to Democrats for saving everything in 2012. But also I think a lot of them thought, you know, Hillary wouldn't have saved the big three. That she would have been more in the Rahm Emanuel wing of like, let the free market do its work. And so I think she did not get the same credit that Obama got in 2012 for that. I think that cost her big in the Rust Belt states that cost her the White House.
And this also speaks to Trump's realignment ability. Trump definitely would have bailed out the big three.
Sure.
In a way that he'd Jeb and his other
he'd get a great deal.
The best deal would pay for itself. you know, which funny enough, the bailouts actually did do. So it's kind of like a but he, I think, would have politically done a better job of just owning that. So that kind of takes us to the squad itself. So here's what I'm really interested in. Like I don't know how you are, but you and I, given the spaces we serve in the media, we get to interact with a lot of different categories of person. And the category of person you really catalog in the book that I kind of spend the least amount of time with are like activist types. So people who aren't like party hacks, right? They're not people who like, because I went to GW my freshman year, it's where I met Sagar. I know of a type of person who had 18 dreams of working at the DNC. I very literally know this type of person. The activist types are very different. They're kind of, they're political, but almost like frustratedly so. To what degree does this persona, kind of expand it. Like, tell me about this persona. Like, it's 2015. You're kind of pissed off about the way the past 7 years have gone. And it's also crucially before Trump has surprised everyone. And it's fashionable to say, well, it's time to reimagine politics now, right? Like the type of people who are first drawn to Bernie's campaign before Hillary appears to be a bad bet.
Right. Yeah. These are people who, like you said, they don't see politics as a career. They would never be caught dead in a college Democrats club meeting. You know, they think those are worse people than the college Republicans. At least the college Republicans are like, they know what they're, you know, they understand them, but the college Democrats are like, what is that about? If you want to get a job, go get a job. If you want to change the world, be an activist. What's this weird middle ground of being a college Democrat? And so yeah, the activists are driven by a sense of conscience and a sense of rage in particular after the financial crisis, because this is a generation that is looking at, depending on how you want to count, being the first generation in the U.S. to likely be winding up worse than their parents were, and they're blaming specific decisions made by previous generations through deregulation of Wall Street, through not responding with a robust enough push after the financial crisis, not throwing any bankers in jail. And they're looking at the kind of coming collapse of ecosystems and the climate, like, so that on top of it, plus the 2004 cycle really saw the kind of like the kind of bringing to the fore the culture war issues around marriage equality. And so that becomes generational too. Like, it's easy to see them kind of flowing together at the time, rather than how later they start to get kind of pitted against each other.
Yeah, and I think the question I'm kind of wondering here is, very crucially, if we're talking about this 2015 to basically 2018, 2019 space before AOC and the squad members are elected, I think there's a lot of optimism around this idea that you could build this like multiracial, like working class coalition. And I guess what I just like wondered, I'm not meaning this as a personal attack, I just read the profiles of these activists and I'm just like not convinced these are people are quite the people who would do it. I think once again, and this is where it gets really interesting. If you're reading seriously, like about the New Deal era, the like old hate pre-JFK heyday of American politics, I kind of think of the person who forges a coalition as being kind of like a grimy ward boss or like a union leader. I kind of like wonder if the type of person who like joins like an activist campaign, whether that person is a person who builds coalitions versus someone who, like let's say in the 60s, is there to antagonize and push politicians to do this, to push on the establishment. I'm just curious how you think about where these specific cogs in the policy ecosystem or the political ecosystem, where they even fit together.
Yeah, I mean, you do have, and a decent number of the founders of Justice Democrats, which then recruited a lot of the squad members, did come from working class backgrounds. Some Tennessee, Alexandra Rojas, pretty working class upbringing in Connecticut, and then moved, you know, to California to go to community college, so she get in-state tuition there. So, but at the same time, you have the more typical kind of activists that you think of that went to Oberlin or Brown or whatever, and are going to have a harder time, connecting. One of the pivotal moments that I highlight, and I'm sure you notice in the book, is the Joe Rogan moment for Bernie Sanders, where when Bernie Sanders went on there and was interviewed, you know, his aide said that, you know, it not only was it one of the few like measurable increases in polling that they saw from like a media appearance, because that's how big his audience is, that it's actually moving the polling needle from Rogan, like your segment can be Rogan listeners. And they would run into just random regular people who were clearly not like activist Democrats all over the country afterwards, saying, you know, I wasn't a supporter of yours, but I thought it was really interesting. And then later, when Rogan tells Barry Weiss that he's going to vote, you know, during an interview, he's going to vote for Bernie Sanders, the Bernie Sanders team promotes that on Twitter, and they get a big boost in the numbers, but they also get this massive backlash from the kind of online left that then highlights a lot of, you know, his previous comments. They're calling him transphobic or sometimes racist, and it becomes this muddled thing where he's unable to then kind of really stitch together what he's trying to do with, which is this, you know, material-driven class, multiracial, class-based multiracial coalition, which, you know, Rogan's audience has, like, but anyway, so that.
I think that's that actually right there is the perfect anecdote that was kind of getting at what I was trying to ask with the question, which was, but this is also where it gets difficult too, because it seems to me, I just think we're in the kind of vibes era of American politics. And in the vibes era, I think Bernie has really strong vibes. If you actually were to sit down and interview Joe Rogan, like, why did you like Bernie Sanders? He would, I think, almost certainly, and probably said this with Barry Weiss, I haven't watched the interview, but resonates with the critique, resonates with the fact that Bernie, for all of his flaws, if you will, is just clearly not a personally corrupt person. Mm-hmm. Rogan would like all of that. But I think if you were then to then dial down into a bunch of policies beyond kind of like a vague universal healthcare, which Joe Rogan almost certainly supports, whether it's the jobs guarantee or the Green New Deal. With a lot of these policies, I think you could very quickly get Elon Musk to convince Joe Rogan to not support those policies, especially like, you know, post COVID Joe Rogan, not, you know, talking crap, right, but it's just like an obvious, like clear reality there. So I guess what I'm kind of asking you here is, what's so interesting about your characterization of the squad is like this deep focus on policy, the papers, the line by lines, this is what we're trying to achieve. How sustainable is that Joe Rogan coalition once you move beyond vibes and start getting at costs? Hey, Joe Rogan, like, Elon's probably going to pay more taxes under this dynamic. Hey, Joe Rogan, we're actually pretty hostile to a lot of the people you spend time with and speak with. Hey, Joe Rogan, parts of this coalition are going to basically say to themselves, we're not going to be the black people of the New Deal era thrown under the bus to get this broader coalition done. It's just not worth it. So I guess how sustainable was that kind of like perfect pre-cost Joe Rogan Bernie synthesis?
Well, clearly it wasn't. It lasted like a week or two and kind of fell apart. If there had been more prep done ahead of time, if the Bernie campaign had been more intentional in talking with the squad and outside organizations about what their strategy was around that, maybe that helps. But you have to remember they're also in the midst of a primary campaign that also includes a lot of Bernie Sanders opponents, you know, who have, including on the left, you know, who have every reason to kind of weaponize whatever differences they can. Even people who were trying to get Rogan's, you know, either support or get on would say like, oh, look at the thing after he's endorsed or said he's going to vote for Bernie. It's like, oh, look at the things he said. So in that intramural context, it's tough to see how it how it holds together. But maybe there's, you know, I mean, the ship has sailed, it seems like, at this point, for foreseeable future. But maybe there was a path.
Something I'm interested in, if you're looking at, and we're kind of jumping all over the place, but we're interested, like, people should buy the book. I'm interested in, like, the big ideas here that can then you can apply the reporting to. But so if it's 2018, 2019, AOC is elected, you have all these, like, political insurgencies, I think it'd be possible for someone to think, okay, we're going to see a replication of the Tea Party dynamic, not just pushing the party to the left, but, like, actually engaging in a drag out fight style politics where there's, you know, some pretty direct short-term kamikazeing of oneself, but, like, hey, like, it's worth it because we kind of thrive in chaos. That very much didn't happen. What's kind of, like, your summation of why obviously the squad is to the left of Hakeem Jeffries, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think the policy views have changed, but there's just clearly a comfort or a recognition of their place within the coalition that doesn't exist on the Tea Party right, for good and for ill. Because I think the Tea Party right consistently overreached. So, for example, you didn't see a bunch of 2022 midterms where squad-style Democrats win primaries and then lose winnable Senate races. So, like, I'm not just, and then I think this is what's lost with the online left, which is that, no, like, you could say AOC should behave much more like Jim Jordan, but actually, just, you know, there's, like, a very incredibly terrible cost for engaging with that if you're not thinking that out. So I'm just curious what kind of, like, happens there.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is a big part of it, that they just personally were not, like, trying to do that type of thing that people expected them perhaps to be doing, but that wasn't really what they were there for. And I think people have to remember the context of, you know, 2019, half that year spent fighting with Pelosi and fighting with Trump kind of equally, and then AIPAC and DMFI coming up on the side. And then immediately you're into the presidential election. And so in the Republican primary, presidential primary, burning the party down is actually a credential. You know, Republicans hate their establishment. So going up against it is a badge of honor. Democratic primary voters are not like that. They still support the party. And so for Bernie Sanders to win, he's going to have to win not just 30 some percent that supports him. He's going to have to then win a big chunk. Okay. He's going to have to win a big chunk of the normie voters who love Democrats and are nervous about Bernie and the revolution. So that's a time when AOC made this remark that really got her in a bunch of trouble with people calling Pelosi Mama Bear. But the context of that was, look, she's trying to say that Pelosi supports them. People understood it as her, like, saying something nice about Pelosi. But what she was saying is, Pelosi's tough. She's attacked us a lot, but she's a mama bear. And me, Bernie, and Pelosi are going to be a team together. And so you normie Democratic voters out there should give us the reins of power. And so because they were trying to win the party's nomination, and doing so requires being well-liked by these normie Democrats, I think that inhibited a bit some of the Matt Gaetz-style stuff you might see.
And this is where I think the activist persona type that's especially prominent on Twitter has difficulty by, like, kind of circling, because let me put it this way, I'm not on 15 different levels, I'm not, like, a squad type of my politics, but from my perspective, I would say, okay, here's, like, the brass tacks of the situation. Our base right now, especially during a Trump era, is just going to be these, like, center left wine suburban moms. They love Nancy Pelosi. So what we need to do, but they love Nancy Pelosi, but they also, like, aren't exactly paying, like, hyper attention to policy. So what we need to do is just make them, to your point, not afraid of us, talk about Mama Bear, be anti-Trump, and then, you know, let's bring some Green New Deal to it. Let's have the Climate Conservation Corps thrown in there. Because ultimately, like, our base of the party doesn't actually, you know, this, like, I always get in this fight with Kyle Kulinski, but, like, if you actually look through the polling, there's, like, plenty of things, like, within the squad's agenda that's completely compatible with kind of, like, a center-left, like, worldview and, like, the baseline thing. But just, like, the flashing red light of being anti-Pelosi, of being Matt Gaetz-esque, is so devastating that I just think that like there's a deep empathy gap on the online left that just doesn't understand that dynamic. And that's what you're actually facing. You're not actually facing this. And by the way, if you could win your primary, and this is what the truth is, I think if AOC could win her primaries by just dunking on Nancy Pelosi and just for all time, that's a different world. If Chuck Schumer were unpopular, there's a world where AOC is the next senator from New York, but that just isn't the reality. And I think an activist kind of struggles to be when they run up against, there are things we can change, but there's actually like a boundary line. But at the same time, just to stop this, to end this rant, you just pointed out at the start of the episode, so many Obama policy troubles start from being too obsessed with acceptable discourse and lines. So if you're a Democratic Party or squad activist right now, you both recognize that the party has suffered when we've been too constrained by lines and rules. But then you also suffer if you don't recognize there actually are ones that actually exist.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that there's ecosystems also prevent people from learning some of the things that you're talking about. Like, I cover Congress, so I see this stuff firsthand. That's one of the ecosystems I'm in. I also cover movements and social movements and activists. So I like see that ecosystem as well. You can recognize that they're not overlapping. And so if you would say like, hey, Nancy Pelosi is actually pretty popular at a very surface level with a lot of Democratic voters, that wouldn't land. What are you talking about? No, I don't know anybody that likes her. It's like, well, that's right. I know you don't know anybody who likes her, but that's because that's what your ecosystem is. And the squad is kind of thrust into Congress. And so just is, and by virtue of running, by going on MSNBC, by going around the country, by running in elections where everybody votes, you just get a broader kind of view than just an activist might. Yeah. Not that they don't have their role, but yeah.
Something I'm curious about, and I was telling you this before the episode, but I worked on the PBS reboot of Firing Line of Margaret Hoover. So I was quite literally in the room when AOC first got in her controversy about Israel, Palestine, et cetera. And this isn't like a foreign policy debate episode, so I'm more curious about the structure. If we're actually identifying areas where there's deep coalitional weakness, it almost certainly would have to be U.S. foreign policy. I mean, there's plenty of people in the Democratic Party who could stomach Green New Deal talk, healthcare talk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Clearly, and you saw this once again during that 2018 incident, Israel, Palestine, U.S. rule in the world is just like this real, it's this touch point. And I guess where I'd be curious to understand from you is, where does the squad's kind of like left approach on foreign policy come from? Because there are plenty of like Congressional Black Caucus Democrats, or like obviously Black, there are plenty of like POC Democrats who are still kind of in line with like the center left consensus, and therefore this isn't an issue. But I'm just like really interested in like, where are the origins of this like third rail effectively?
I think it comes from being rooted in kind of left wing communities. I think early Congressional Black Caucus members often had, pretty left-wing foreign policy views as well. It's as the more established members start coming in that you get a more kind of establishment, take on foreign policy. Ilhan Omar obviously comes from being on the other side of the gun. Mm-hmm. Like I was there in her office very early on when she met with a whole group of anti-war veterans that wanted to work with her in coalition to help, end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, she was quite willing and happy to have them on her side. But it was also like a really surreal experience, because she was so used to kind of, as a child, being on the other side of the gun. And so that comes quite naturally to her, and also to Rashida Tlaib, who, of course, whose mother is from Ramallah, and has very direct experience with the occupation there. I think for Presley. It comes because the person she beat, Capuano, for one, was one of the leading kind of progressive foreign policy figures. And people really liked that about him. So she's kind of carried that mantle. Yeah, and for AOC, I think it just flows from her kind of rooting in those more left-wing communities. But you're exactly right that, yeah, when it comes to like Medicare for All, you've got, you know, Bernie on Medicare for All, you've got Obama saying he's for a public option, and you can negotiate in between. They're both kind of in the same direction. One's further than the other. That's not the case with like Israel, Palestine, or say for some Ukraine or some, or other, you know, some people are for the war, some people are against it. Some people are for these different adventures. Some people are against them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the last big section here, so two questions, I'll go one at a time. So one, obviously 2024 next year is going to be this huge political year, but I'm increasingly just obsessed with 27 to 2028, because that is going to be the year where the actual generational changes occurred. So like whether or not Trump wins next year, Trump's done, Biden's done, Hillary's obviously out. You are going to have an open field. Because even in 2020, because once again, like Bernie almost certainly was never going to win a nomination where Trump was at stake. Because when Trump is the Republican nominee, by definition, the number one question Democratic Party voters are going to ask themselves is who is just the most electable person. A Mitt Romney election, a John McCain election, that's actually a much more favorable environment for someone like Bernie, the squad, et cetera, is kind of like pushing on it. So maybe 2028 could be that type of election space. I'm not asking you for a prediction because I know people hate those, but just how could maybe you see the various forces you're reporting on play out in a political moment where for the first time in 10 years, we're not basically responding to Donald Trump.
Right. Although theoretically, if Trump loses, does he run again?
The greatest fact check I've ever gotten in my entire life. Not even kidding. But B, let's just posit he's actually just done for whatever reason.
He died.
Yeah,
he died. Well,
your word's
not
mine. It's over.
It's over.
2027. Like, how would they respond to an actual open field?
I mean, I think there's a chance that somebody like AOC gets in. I think a lot of it depends on what happens in these midterms. Like, if the squad can fend off this attempted $100 million challenge from AIPAC.
And you mean not the midterms, the 2024 election, right?
Sorry. Yes. The House races. In particular, because like the squad is, you know, seeing challenges in most of these races, in most of their races. And so if they can survive those and grow their support even in between 2024 and 26, then they go in, I think, in a catbird seat in the sense that the boomers are aging out and the younger people are aging in. You know, for the first time, younger people actually are more liberal rather than just kind of the media either pretending or thinking they are. Like, polling actually shows this cohort, Gen Z, if they read books, which I don't think they necessarily do, no offense out Gen Z, they listen on audio. But if they listen on audio to my book, they'd be like, what's controversial about any of this? Like, how on earth is this group of politicians controversial? Like, they're like dead squad is like dead in the center of like Gen Z. And so as that cohort, you know, and millennials make up a bigger portion of the electorate overall, I think they wind up in a more dominant position. I don't know if dominant, but like a more powerful position.
And yeah, because once again, you're still going to run into like 50+1 urban rural divide issues. But I think under your articulation here, I see the squad being a much more fully formed part of the Democratic Party's coalition. Because once again, what I think some of the doomerism around 2019, 2020 just misunderstood was the inherent weakness of the position relative to, once again, the Trump years. So here's the final question here. How should the squad react to inflation politics? I'm really fascinated by this idea. Like I'm funded by like the Hewlett Foundation. So I do a lot of like work around like this post neoliberalism space, and like the skepticism I always have when people say that like we're moving on from neoliberalism is that like the neoliberal moment was a direct response to the inflation of the mid to late 1970s. So if we're reinserting this cataclysmic, I don't mean like cataclysmic in the sense of like we're in a second Great Depression, people are way too online with the discourse here, but once again, like foundational, like if we're taking us back to the start of our conversation, there's a generation of politicians and activists who have their political mindset and possibilities rooted in an Obama failure 2009. You're going to have a bunch of Democrats who will have their mindset rooted in, man, if it wasn't for abortion in 2022, we just spent so much money. We weren't rewarded for it politically. The CTC expired and the polling said that nobody cared and inflation became this massive albatross. I'm just not going to think of big multi-trillion dollar programs. Maybe we could have kind of dialed it back. So I'm just, that's kind of like a reaction I have. I'm curious what your final reaction would be there.
I don't think that story has been written yet. I think, you know, the Fed, for instance, met today and is keeping interest rates stable, and they signaled a potential cut coming in the future. If they do engineer a soft landing here, where you keep unemployment under 4%, you get inflation back down to, you know, whatever their target is, 2%, and people see their worker power grow, and people see their real wages grow over the next year, you could start to see Democrats get actually rewarded for that, despite the inflation that we saw in that period. They have to, like, you've got to break the housing crisis, because you're going, you know, that's the thing that is kind of tearing everything apart. And so I think those are the open questions. And if you can, you know, break that housing logjam, bring housing prices back to what, you know, something reasonable, then I think people will look back and be like, oh, that was good. Like, we're better off than we used to be.
Man, that's a great place to leave it, because you're making me realize that ultimately these questions, I think I'm asking the right questions, but they all are going to hinge on 2024's outcome. So like if Joe Biden loses, I think very clearly people are going to say like, man, inflation just was too much of an albatross. But if he wins, the story, I'm not just saying you're doing this in the sense of you're being a Biden stan, the story you just told will be the story that everyone tells. They'll say, yeah, like there was this temporary hiccup, but like we stayed strong and Trump was just so bad that it came together. And now we're going to advance into our second term where we truly finish off neoliberalism, insert. So that's a great place to leave it, both on the midterm. So people should look to how the squad performs in those actual congressional races. But then what is the dominant narrative going into 2025 as setting the stage for the squad's success or failure in the political system? Ryan, this has been really great. Once again, read the book.
Fun.
So it's good to kind of ask the reader questions of you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.